Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Website is scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. scotthorton.org. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. And by the way, if you listen to the interview-only podcast archives of this show, you might not know that this show's live from 3 to 5 Eastern Time at LibertyExpressRadio.com every weekday. So now you know. All right. Our next guest is our friend Adam Morrow, IPSNews.net. For Interpress Service, who employs him, and he writes for them from Cairo, Egypt. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Adam?
Good, Scott. Thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And, hey, listen, so today's the big day of the big referendum on the new Egyptian constitution. I guess, first of all, what can you tell us about the turnout, who's voting, who's boycotting, what's the big deal, and then maybe we can get into the text of the thing.
Sure. Well, as it stands right now, we saw the first day of voting. It'll be 2 days. There's another day of voting tomorrow. And until now, it's been very difficult to gauge exactly what sort of turnout we're looking at, mainly because all of the local media across the board and much of the international media as well has intentionally downplayed the size of opposition to the Constitution, and have played up public support for the constitutional referendum. So until now, it's difficult. We've seen images on television channels of people lining up on queues, but people have also commented that it's nothing like the size of, or it doesn't appear to, at least it doesn't appear to be like the size of the turnout that we saw for Egypt's first post-revolutionary parliamentary election, which was in late 2011. So it was nothing mind-blowing today. I mean, a lot of people were sort of bracing themselves for another June 30th type turnout, which, if you remember, June 30th of last year were the big demonstrations calling for Morsi's ouster, mm-hmm. in which millions of people took to the streets of Egypt. And there was, I mean, no one can deny that there was a massive popular turnout last year for that. But we didn't really see the same sort of thing this time around. Granted, it's only been the first day of voting, and we're going to have another day of voting, and people say we might see a large turnout late tomorrow as sort of all the, like, final stragglers sort of run to the polling stations. But up until this point, it hasn't been particularly overwhelming. Needless to say, the pro-army media is pushing it, is showing all these images of people standing online. All the pro-army newspapers are pumping out headlines that say, you know, Egyptians turn out in massive numbers to endorse the constitution and General Sisi and General Sisi's roadmap for political future and all of this sort of stuff. But facts on the ground, the numbers weren't particularly overwhelming. And what we can also do is we can also look at how the expatriate vote went. And that was 5 days last week, during which it looks like turnout was nothing more than between 10 and 15% of Egypt's expatriate community, which I think you're talking about something like 600,000 registered voters who are living abroad. And for that, we only saw between 10 and 15% turnout. So up until now, it's very difficult to say, but it's certainly not huge numbers that the government was hoping for.
All right, now I guess the real question is, does it matter? Because the military is going to win this election one way or the other, aren't they?
Well, yeah. Well, that's what everybody's saying, and that was the main motivation for the Muslim Brotherhood and allied groups to boycott the vote, because there was definitely this assumption that, look, it's going to pass either way. The yes is going to be, it's probably going to be in the 80 or 90% in terms of approval, regardless of what even if that is a small turnout. So the thinking was, and rightfully, I think it was a right move that opponents of General Sisi in general and the Constitution in particular have chosen to boycott. But yeah, there's also been increased talk. There's also been a lot of talk recently about the likelihood of vote rigging, especially because a lot of the people who are running the vote right now, who are controlling the polling right now, are the same people that were doing the very same thing during the Mubarak regime, which was famous for vote rigging. I mean, under the Mubarak regime, it was done, you know, blatantly. It was sort of an open secret. Everybody knew, all Egyptians knew that the voting was rigged. But this time around, you've got the same group of people who are back at the controls of who are monitoring the elections. The judiciary, for example, Egyptian judges have been tasked with monitoring the vote, and they are all well-known Mubarak appointees.
Mm. Well, so, you know what? Even without a bunch of ballot box stuffing and that kind of thing. With calls for a boycott, that obviously just splits the vote between the opposition, those who don't bother participating in it at all because it's such a sham, and those who go ahead and try to participate anyway in order to defeat the thing. And so what ends up happening, I guess, then, is they might as well have rigged it, because then they win by such a large percentage. They get to claim a big mandate and popular consent across the board and all of that, and deny the boycott even happened.
Or right, ignore it. Right. There's also not a very big international presence. I know the Carter, the Carter Center, which will often send delegations to monitor these elections. They were here for the last batch of elections, which they approved, which they gave their stamp of approval to. This time around, I don't think they were allowed access to it. I think they were actually shut down. I think they are, I might be wrong about that, but they're certainly monitoring it or observing it. They're not going to be there in force like they were last year, and that has kind of raised eyebrows. And then, of course, that's chalked up. A lot of people say, well, you've got this incredible anti-Americanism now going, so a lot of people are saying, like, screw the Americans who, don't let them observe their elections. They're biased towards the Muslim Brotherhood anyway. You've got this weird dynamic as well. But it all points to. A victory for this constitution either way.
I think that's kind of funny and unique, and maybe too obvious, but I like there's humor that works, that the military strategy is that, well, geez, since we're the sock puppets of the Americans, our lead narrative ought to be that the Muslim Brotherhood are the sock puppets of the Americans, and just try to get out ahead of that narrative and just push it so hard that it seems true, like the big lie,
Yeah, it was definitely a masterstroke by sort of claiming the anti-American card, which had been in the domain of the Islamists for so long. That was a stroke of genius.
And then that it worked. I mean, hey. Who knew the Egyptian people were so credulous when it comes to that kind of thing?
Well, if anything, Scott, I gotta say, if anything that we've seen over the course of the last couple of months, if you can draw a single conclusion to all of the stuff that we've seen, is that the Egyptian people are unfortunately very, very credulous.
There's that new movie, and I'm afraid I didn't see the new movie, but I read a review of it, and it was, in fact, a friend sent it to me saying, wow, this reminds me of your talks with Adam Morrow, because the review, and I think it was actually a Council on Foreign Relations guy reviewing it in Foreign Policy or in Foreign Affairs or something like that. But he was basically saying, yeah, these protester kids, they got so into being protester kids, they forgot what the hell they were doing there and what it all meant and whatever. So, for example, last June, July, when there were big calls for everyone to come out in the street to protest the Muslim Brotherhood, the question wasn't just, hey, do you like the Muslim Brotherhood, or it shouldn't have been. The question was, hey, do you feel like being a prop for the military this weekend as they use you as an excuse to overthrow the Muslim Brotherhood and cancel the last elections? That was the question.
Sure.
But instead, these kids are like, yay, come on, let's go protest some more, or whatever. Just
exactly.
Like young American
exactly.
Hippies, basically.
There was a lot of that going on. It was a lot of, like, sort of hyped up kids. Maybe some of them had missed the 18 days, hadn't really had a chance to participate in the 18 days, so were therefore, sort of looking for a way to establish their, their manly credentials. So any opportunity that arose, and this was particularly the case when Morsi was president, because there were a lot of forces that were actively trying to destabilize Egypt while he was president. And one of the ways that was done was by constantly creating these you know, these clashes or these protest, these demonstration-type situations where often when you sort of look back at it now, you wonder, you know, was there really a credible reason for people to go out and hit the street? And you realize that a lot of it was manipulation. And stuff has come out subsequently. There was a report that Morsi commissioned when he was president that didn't get released, basically about some of the clashes between protesters and police in the wake of the revolution, that he commissioned. It didn't see the light of day until recently, until several months after his ouster. It was only like maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, Gazeta finally released a leaked copy of it, and it explicitly stated that that the security services were intended to provoke the revolutionaries, that they were there to provoke them, that they wanted a response, they were trying to draw them out. They were trying to draw them into conflict and violent clashes and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And again, we realize now this was all with the express intent of doing two things: of alienating the Egyptian people from the idea of the revolution. That's a big thing. That idea, that dynamic has played a really, really big role in Egypt after the revolution, is this idea there were definitely forces at work that were trying very hard to basically make the Egyptian people fed up with the instability. They wanted to constantly cause crises and chaos to the point where the average Egyptian would be like, you know what? To hell with this January 25 revolution business. It was better under Mubarak when everything was stable. You know, after 1 year, 2 years of this incessant instability and chaos, a lot of people were sort of saying, a lot of people who had been happy to see Mubarak go and thought he was corrupt, a lot of those same people, and this is like much of the silent majority, sort of come around and say, you know something, it wasn't worth it. You know, after 2 years of this, it wasn't worth it. We want things to go back to how they were. And I think that was one of the big strategies that the counter-revolution used, and one of the reasons why you will get a substantial turnout on this referendum. You know, you are going to get millions of people are going to approve it, are going to vote yes for it, and I would say the vast majority of those are average Egyptians who have just seen all the chaos and have just been like, look, we want a Mubarak-like figure again back to reimpose order, to pass draconian legislation banning street protests, and to just basically put things back to normal, back to pre-January 25th, reality.
Yeah. All right, now, so what about this new constitution? You know what? We don't even have time. We're about to have to take a break here in a minute. So I'll tell you what, sure. When we get back from this break, Adam, I want to ask you about what's in the Constitution, the form of the government as compared to the last one.
Sure.
And then, of course, the trial balloons are already leaking. There was a whole contest going on Twitter there for people coming up with puns about CC running for president. Oh, I didn't CC
right,
that
right.
coming. And stuff like that. Anyway, we'll be right back with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, IPSnews.net. Live on the phone from Cairo, right after this.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service. That's IPSnews.net. And he's a reporter living in Cairo. We're talking about the referendum on the new constitution today and I don't know. I mean, is this thing just cut and dry, basically just a fig leaf for the new, again, military dictatorship of Egypt, Adam? Or is there more to
it? Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, definitely. And I don't think it's people. It's not a new constitution. Also, people need to understand that it's actually an amended version of Morsi's constitution. Because if you remember, under Morsi, they also did a constitutional a constituent assembly of 100 members, I think, and endorsed a constitution last year, which was also put before a referendum and passed with a 63.5% approval rating, I think. And what we're seeing now, what's being voted on now, is an amended version of that, which actually doesn't. It's not that different. I think there are only 20 or something changes or something like that between the two constitutions. But there have definitely been the power of the army has definitely been expanded, and I know the defense minister is on top. The position of the defense minister becomes basically immune from any kind of oversight whatsoever, including that of the president for like an 8-year period or something like that. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, I saw McClatchy. They said that. I highlighted it in yellow, but it went away somehow. But it was something about CC's position. CC's position being enshrined. Yeah, here it is. It enshrines El-Sisi's place at the top of the military, forbidding his dismissal by anyone other than the country's top military command. So you can have your little president and your little parliament and do your game for TV, but he's going to be the dictator from now on. And then he's saying he's going to run for president anyway. What do you think about that?
The Sisi for president thing has been going back and forth ever since the coup. You definitely get the sense that these are repeated. I think you said it earlier. These are repeated trial balloons where they're trying to get a sense of just what kind of reaction they would get to that. Personally, I think it's the height of stupidity unless these guys actually want a civil war, which isn't entirely out of the question. But you're basically taking the most divisive guy in the country. You know, you're basically taking a guy that, yeah, sure, several million people like love him now and idolize him now, but several million other people, and possibly even more than that, possibly like tens of million people, actually see as a cold-blooded murderer. A good portion of that actually, like, you know, are holding daily demonstrations calling for vengeance against this guy, you know, calling for this guy's execution. So, I mean, you couldn't pick, really. I mean, honestly, you could not pick a more dangerous or divisive or potentially, destructive person for the role of president. I mean, if the army wanted a front man, they should, they got plenty of other people. They could choose, but Sisi, of all people, it seems almost calculated. Like they want it, that they're just trying to alienate their Islamist constituent even further and drive them to the point of some kind of physical war. I mean, that's. On a related note, Ahmed Shafiq, if you remember Ahmed Shafiq, who was Mubarak's last prime minister and who narrowly lost to Morsi last year, has apparently just come back to Egypt from the Gulf. He's been in Abu Dhabi ever since he lost the election, actually. He's been in Abu Dhabi, and the rumor has it that he's back in Egypt now. So there's also speculation that he might actually, if Sisi doesn't stand, then you have Ahmed Shafiq being the sort of the military's candidate.
Mm-hmm. And now, so is it expected that the new parliament will be basically the same as before, only now no Muslim Brotherhood members will be allowed to be elected under any circumstances? But other than
that's
the form
funny.
Will
I
be
mean,
the same
parliament, like, you know, the same parliament as before, but no Islamists. The Islamists were 75% of the last parliament. A parliament which remained in place from early 2012 to I think lasted for about 5 or 6 months. Actually, right in the middle of this hotly contested presidential election last year, the army suddenly issued the order to dissolve the parliament based on this obscure sort of judicial technicality about the election. So the idea that you would have the same parliament like last time, only no Islamists. I mean, it's like. This is the big question. If there are no Islamists, who are the only ones who really managed to command any sort of wide-ranging public support? If they're not there, who is the electorate expected to vote for? You know, you've got all these like liberal parties and leftist parties and stuff like that, but they really they don't they command very little in the way of popular support. So the question really is, I mean, you'll probably get a resurgence of the national Hosni Mubarak, the National Democratic Party. I think you're probably going to see a lot of those guys who were sidelined, you know, and sort of driven into hiding after the revolution. I think you're going to see a lot of those guys come back into the light. You're going to see a lot of parties, if not a straight up reanimation of the National Democratic Party. You're certainly going to have parties that are just going to be stocked with former members of Mubarak's National Democratic Party. Mm. So that's probably what the Egyptians are going to be expected to choose between. So again, we talked about this last time, the idea of trying to eliminate a political current that accounted for 75% of the last parliamentary election, to try to eliminate them entirely from the political scene is going to be a very tall order. I mean, I don't think it really can be done. The way it looks now is, at the very least, even if they do manage to continue, the military-backed government does manage to follow this roadmap that it's called for, which includes constitutional referendum and then parliamentary and presidential elections. Even if they do manage to do that, you're still going to have, you know, a low to medium intensity, something that's sort of in between, you know, demonstrations, perpetual demonstrations, and like a low level insurgency. You're gonna have this going on for the foreseeable future, you know, unless they really come down hard, and you know, unless they start killing tens of thousands of people. There's no other way they're going to be able to stop the opposition, the Islamist opposition that has a street presence on a daily basis until now. Mm-hmm. We talked last time about how there was some escalation. We've seen some escalations, and those protests, those demonstrations were slowly turning into, although still committed to peaceful protest, we were starting to see police cars and police vehicles getting torched on a daily basis, which is still going on. You're starting to see a lot of demonstrations. Today, I don't think we mentioned, at least 11 people were killed countrywide when security forces broke up, you know, moved in to break up anti-referendum and pro-boycott demonstrations that were being held around the country. So, in the foreseeable future, at least, I mean, absent, you know, unbelievable repression, Egypt is definitely looking at a period of instability for the short to midterm, at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes a little bit of sense in a way from the military dictatorship's point of view. If they can, you know, marginalize and radicalize all the Islamists, then that becomes the sort of self-perpetuating excuse for excluding them. You know what I mean?
Right. I think that was the plan from the very beginning. And people have noticed that the behavior of the army after they sidelined Morsi. I mean, they immediately rounded up and arrested all of these guys who were all like elected officials and stuff. They immediately rounded them up and arrested them. And not only that, but they really cracked down on these resultant pro-Morsi protests, which anybody would have been able to predict. If you're going to do this, if you're going to oust a democratically elected president who's only been in office for 1 year and represents the country's first ever democratically elected leader, of course you're going to have an enormous, you know, there's going to be an enormous popular backlash. It might not be violent, but at the very least, with Egypt's post-revolutionary fervor, you're going to get huge, huge demonstrations and protests, which is exactly what we saw.
Yeah, it's too bad because it seems like a good strategy could also be, especially post-coup, obviously the military has won not just this round, but they basically won the war here. So why not go ahead and incorporate the conservative old men of the Islamists, allow them to be in the parliament, allow them to participate in the government in a minority, with a minority stake, not with their own president and their own supermajority like it was for a year and a half there. And then, you know, that way to sort of let the pressure out. I mean, I guess it makes sense for them to do it one way or the other, and they seem to be picking the hard way by trying to turn it into a damn civil war.
What you just described was the Salafist Noor Party, which is the single Islamist party that still remains in existence. Why? Because it signed on to the coup. When they had the military coup, the Noor Party endorsed it. It was the one Islamist party that endorsed the coup and sent representatives to the Constituent Assembly to help draft the constitution. These guys, though, I mean, they've lost, from what I can tell. They've lost, you know, unbelievable popularity. They're seen largely in Islamist circles as like the ultimate betrayers, you know, the ultimate betrayers that they basically joined the coup against the democratically elected Islamist president.
I have this terrible feeling, Adam, that it's so important that we cover this in as much detail as we can now, because in the near future, the midterm future, we'll be looking back at right at this time as the context of the horrible developments that'll be going on then. That, remember how it didn't have to be this way, but they made it this way.
I hope that's not the case, but I have to say I do have the feeling that there will come a time in the not too distant future when we do look back at this at the present now and say to ourselves, you know, and say we never knew how bad it was going to get. I hope it doesn't come to anything like that. And also to the credit of the Islamist opposition,
real,
I mean, they have remained peaceful for the most part.
Right. Yeah, very important point to make. The groups doing the fighting in the Sinai, they were already there, and that's not the Muslim Brotherhood, right?
Exactly, exactly.
All right. Hey, we got to go. I'm sorry we're all out of time. Thanks very much for your time, as always, Adam.
Sure, my pleasure. Take care, Scott.
All right, everybody, that's Adam Morrow, IPSnews.net, reporting from Cairo. See you tomorrow. Thanks.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey y'all, Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.